Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City 88.7 FM with Frances Nesbitt and Max Morrissey.
Hello and welcome to the Kitchen Garden on Community Radio Kilkenny City. I'm Frances Nesbitt and I'm joined as usual by Mags Morrissey. We're live today, Friday, and the show is repeated on Monday from 4 to 5. We'd love to hear from you, so feel free to send us any questions or comments that you might have. You can get in touch with the show by text to 086 353 7782, by phone on 776 2777, or email kitchengarden@ckc.ie. If you're listening to a repeat of the show on Monday afternoon, don't bother texting as we won't get to see your message, but you can still email us. Today on the show, we'll be talking about water. There's lots of it about at the moment. We'll be talking about fish and the marine environment. We'll be joined shortly on the phone by Dr. Anne-Marie Power, Senior Lecturer in Marine Biology at the Ryan Institute and NUI Galway. And later in the show, we'll be talking to Tongi Tutelei about freshwater fish and the freshwater environment. And we might also ask him how he's getting on in his garden in lovely Durrow in County Leash. We hope you and yours are all dry and haven't suffered too much water damage. Mags.
Hello.
It's wet out there.
Yes, it is. But I actually have just driven up from Inishdeag where the sun was actually shining the whole way up, which is quite nice. And I think grass is starting to think about turning a little bit shade of green. But there's floods everywhere. The river's so high, like it's up at the top, and it has been for a long time. And there's floods in every second field. My fields are absolutely flooded. You couldn't put anything on them.
There's just nowhere left for the water to go.
No.
So whatever falls now just runs off the top. I have water flowing out at Crowan Cottages where I never saw water flowing before. I was driving in behind a poor guest today and the driveway is a long gravel driveway and it was just two streams. And the poor person, they were so nervous about where to drive, you know, because it's just all water.
Water,
yeah. No, I was in a hurry, so it probably didn't help that I was right behind them, but ready to splash away. But it was very, very wet.
Well, the forecast is for dry tomorrow and on Sunday, so that it might be 2 days of dry weather would be nice.
It absolutely would. It's badly needed. In the garden, of course, everything is behind schedule. I said last week on the show that Facebook had reminded me that last year the buds or the flowers were already out on the cherry blossom. There's still no sign of buds even on the cherry blossom, so that's way behind schedule. I had some lambs during the week, so I had three lambs born on Easter Sunday. I just had a feeling, actually, that they'd come along on Easter Sunday. And they have been inside most of their lives. They got an afternoon out, and then they were back in again. And at around 2, when the rain stopped today, I threw them out, along with everything else. But they're walking on water, you know, and the water really is at surface level. They share a birthday with you.
Oh, yes,
April
1st. It's my birthday.
Yes.
Happy
birthday.
Nice having a birthday on Easter Sunday, actually.
April
worked quite
Fool's
well.
Day.
Well, you know what? I have to say, I've spent the last 40-odd years kind of listening to April Fool's jokes, and every year people seem to think that I've never heard them before. Hilarious, isn't it? There's probably very few I haven't actually heard.
Your lace is open.
Yeah. Can you get a glass hammer? I know them all.
I'm sure. Now, you were talking about doing a kind of special Easter dinner for Easter Sunday. You were going to do an unusual cut of lamb.
I actually had planned to do shoulder. That's what I was talking about last Friday, and went to the butcher's on, phoned them on Saturday morning, and they didn't have, I needed three, they didn't have them. So I went for lap of lamb or breast of lamb, which is the under part of the sheep. And again, it's kind of a slow cooking one. I've done it once before. But and you can buy it kind of rolled. So I bought it rolled, but I actually loosened it and actually cooked it kind of in a kind of a loose roll, if you like. Added coriander seed, fennel seed, sage, rosemary, thyme, and about a half bottle of white wine. Gave the lamb just a little turn in the oven at like 200 degrees for 20 minutes, and then covered it with all of those ingredients, covered it really tightly, and popped it back in for 3 hours.
Then I presumed you turned the temperature way down then.
Down to 150, yeah.
Mm.
And then added, just drizzled some Highbank apple syrup over the top, and then popped it back in the oven for another 15, 20 minutes. And it was absolutely delicious. My dad was still talking about it yesterday.
Wow.
It was just fabulous, lamby, or, you know, flavour and just falling to pieces. Mm-hmm. Really, really nice. So I was quite delighted with it.
So that's the lap of lamb. That's basically lamb. Like what would be the belly on
the belly,
a piece of pork.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's it.
Very, so, very cheap, I'd say, because mostly that's minced, I'd imagine.
Probably is. I bought three of them for $14.40,
wow,
which fed 11 people.
Okay.
So that, you know, Easter Sunday dinner was, that was really good, wasn't it?
So for a family, you'd get £4 would give you your roast for a Sunday.
Yeah.
A really nice roast.
Yeah.
Wow. Right, we must do that again. I must try
it
that.
It is. It's, yeah. I will do it again. You can do it with shoulder. I think they're probably similar price-wise. But this was just really divine.
And because it's rolled cut, would you ever be tempted to kind of open it out and, you know, put something in and then roll it back up again,
yeah,
maybe stuff it?
Yeah, I've done it actually just completely rolled out, done it flat, and it is quite thin and everything. Mm. And you don't need to cook it for so long if you do it like that. Yeah. You can do a different kind of style with it. That was very tasty as well, but actually I think this was a nicer way. You could roll it, like you could have rolled all of those herbs and garlic. Sorry, I did throw lots of cloves of garlic in as well. You could roll those into it. But to be honest, you're cooking it so slowly, covered for that length the time, all the flavour goes right through it. Mm. So, yeah, you could probably stuff it and roll it, but it does need, when you have it like that, it needs kind of slow cooking. I think it just adds to it anyway, just brings out the flavours.
Right, well, there's another unusual cut. I don't think I've ever gotten one of those back from the butcher. I'm pretty sure that goes into my lamb mince.
Okay.
But I'll definitely ask them to keep one aside the next time.
Yeah, do.
And talk to them about it on when we're doing one of the courses. Now, it was Easter, of course, and Easter means eggs. Was there lots of Easter eggs in your house?
Well, lots of small Easter eggs, yeah. Easter egg hunt is a big event. Easter is kind of big in our house, actually. I thought this year it almost felt like Christmas. You know, you're having a biggish dinner. The weather was miserable outside. The kids, they had all their cousins and, some of their cousins. So we had an Easter egg hunt. Now, it was kind of half outside, half indoors because of the rain. But they love it. They absolutely love it, running around with bags. Even the 15-year-old was spotted running
sulkily
around.
Sulkily running around. Yeah. At church, Ed and Kells, there's always a little Easter egg hunt after the service. And just like that, you know, kids who have no interest in being there and would normally kind of just stand outside, they're charging around looking for the eggs as well. The young kids are lucky if they get one or two, but
the older kids.
Yeah, the older kids have them all taken. Everything up high. Yeah, we had a lovely Easter egg hunt out at Croan as well. And just to say how different our children can be. My son, the son of the engineer, methodically went around the garden examining every spot, cleaning up the Easter eggs, whereas my daughter ran hither and yon, getting distracted by everything. Occasionally grabbing an egg, but mostly just running past them. But it's funny, isn't it?
It is funny, yeah. Indeed.
But leftover Easter eggs is it's always a kind of problem. I get sick looking at them around the place after a while.
Yeah, now I do kind of think you don't need to panic. Like, they won't go off this week or next week, so you can kind of hold on to them for a while if you wish. I have one small boy who would happily go through everything that's there steadily, really.
Yeah.
So I have to kind of keep an eye on him. I actually spotted him last night. He had the base of a bunny, and he was using it to hold his ice cream in it.
Oh, my God.
That was quite innovative, I suppose.
But then I suppose
it?
He has to finish off the whole base of the bunny.
Well, you know, it was a small bunny, in fairness, but even still. We still have plenty of chocolate. There's different things you can make. Like, you want to make chocolate brownies, but if you've had enough chocolate, brownies are probably not what you want. But you do need chocolate in them if you generally need kind of dark chocolate. Mm. Or there's another recipe if you kind of want to ease yourself off chocolate a little bit, chocolate and banana cookies.
Oh, yeah. That
yeah,
sounds nice.
So, or you could add chocolate to make banana bread. Just break up your any kind of chocolate and stuff and add it into banana bread, and that would work quite nicely and stuff. But this, you need 130 grams of butter, 2 tablespoons of honey. There's actually no sugar in this, honey instead. 3 teaspoons of vanilla extract, 2 ripe bananas, 350 grams of flour, 2 teaspoons of baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon of baking soda, 2 teaspoons of hot water, and 150 grams or thereabouts of chocolate chips, broken up Easter eggs, whatever you have. Beat your butter until it's nice and light. Add the honey to the butter and beat it again. Then separately whisk your eggs and your vanilla just for a few minutes and stir all those together. Then add your mashed bananas. You've got quite a wet mixture at this stage. So you've got your flour, your baking powder and your salt then together. Sieve those, fold them into the wet mixture And then the last thing to do is to add your dissolve your bread soda in water, and then add that with the chocolate chips into your mixture. And then you're just literally going to kind of, with a tablespoon or a large dessert spoon, I suppose, heap it out onto your baking tray, kind of a rough little...
cookie shape.
Yeah, yeah. And into the oven for 10, 12 minutes. So, and you can freeze them as well, if you wanted to keep them.
Well, that sounds nice. Yeah. So it's kind of mushed banana in the...
Mashed banana.
Yeah, okay, rather than chunks.
Yeah, so you'll have a nice banana flavour.
I like banana flavour pastries. I really do.
Okay, but I like banana bread, actually.
Mm, banana bread is lovely. Mm. Yeah, I really like cooking with bananas. That's a good way of using up the chocolate. And then, of
course, just going to change something, you know, if it's not pure chocolate that you want yeah. something, yeah, a little lighter.
The chocolate that comes in the Easter egg... It tends to be kind of 20%, 25% cocoa anyway, so it's very, very low. It's mostly like milk chocolates.
It depends, I suppose. Some of them are better than others in that, so yeah. But the milk chocolate's fine for those kind of things. Mm.
I was reading during the week, as we were preparing for the Easter show, that Ireland and the UK have the lowest percentage of cocoa in our chocolate anywhere pretty much in the civilised world.
Really? Even in America?
To be called chocolate on the continent, it has to have 33% cocoa. But for some reason, Ireland and the UK have an exemption and we can get away with 20 or 25%.
Gosh, that's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's actually very little cocoa in your chocolate. All of those benefits we talk about for fermented food and coming from chocolate, I'm afraid you don't get any in your Mars bar.
No.
Or your Snickers.
I didn't think we were getting a lot from Mars bars anyway.
So they don't count towards any of that kind of stuff. Now, I did, as you were talking about spooning out your cookie mixture onto the baking tray there, it reminded me, I lent a hand in the kitchen to Martha, my daughter, who's 9, who is 10 in May, but she was making some rock cakes the other day and asked me for some advice about whether I thought they were done in the oven or not. And one thing you really have to remember as you take these things out of the oven is that they continue to cook for a little while they're hot. So we had a look at the rock cakes at the time she thought that they were ready, and rock buns, and I thought that they needed another couple of minutes. And sure enough, afterwards, although they were absolutely delicious, I think my extra couple of minutes detracted from them a little bit. Yeah, yeah. So they might look a little soft and stuff as you're taking them out, but they continue to cook for a little while.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some tip or trick or something about that, is there? That you can tell whether it's cooked all the way through.
With the rock bun, I'd look underneath. It should have brown colour underneath. If it's too pale, and like it's not going to brown when it's out of the oven, the inside might cook another little bit, but if it's it should be browned underneath and then it's cooked.
Well, this particular recipe that she followed for rock cakes, now I don't know whether there's a difference between a rock cake and a rock bun, but Martha's recipe for rock cakes produced something which was very, very like a scone, but had a less floury, less crumbly texture.
Well, it's a wetter mixture.
Yeah, much more unctuous kind of taste in the mouth, just with butter. It was absolutely delicious. They were really, really good. Yeah. Now, I kept one to bring into the studio.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
I'd love.
Yeah, so we'll have that during the
bun.
Break. It's not out in the car at all, I swear. I didn't forget to bring it in.
There's a picture of one you brought.
There's a picture of one here, actually. Yeah. Because Martha, I told her I'd give them a mention on the show today, and she sent me out with the recipe.
Very good.
So I'll do a recipe now. Well, normally this is your kind of remit, but I'll read this out if people want to take this down. And actually, we might start putting the recipes up on kitchengarden.ie. If you want to check out kitchengarden.ie, we'll have the recipes up there shortly. So this one is for rock cakes. And it needs 225 grams of self-raising flour, 75 grams of caster sugar, although she used granulated sugar, I know that for a fact, 1 teaspoon of baking powder, 125 grams of butter, cut into cubes. And the smaller you cut the cubes, I think the easier it is to work into the flour.
Especially for little fingers, yeah.
Yeah. And now at this point, she made half of them with dried fruit and half without dried fruit. But of course, you can add in as much dried fruit as you like into those. And then a free-range egg, which kind of ties it all together, and a little bit of milk. And then 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract went into that. So basically, she lined a baking tray with some parchment and mixed the flour, sugar, baking powder all in a bowl and rubbed in the cubed butter until it looks like breadcrumbs. And then put in the fruit into half of it. And in a clean bowl, she beat the egg and the milk together with the vanilla extract and then added that mixture to the dry ingredients, stirred it all together, and then kind of portioned it out into little golf ball size cakes. And they were absolutely delicious after 22 minutes in the oven, but they should have had 20 minutes in the oven at about 180 degrees centigrade. So well done, Martha. That were
very
absolutely
good.
Lovely. And I'll, at the ad break, I'll nip outside and get the ones that you can try it.
I can't wait. I like the fruit ones.
Now, it's April, so this is our first show of April, and I generally love April because it's a sign of things to come and everything is brightening up and all of that, but this is a particularly harsh one. But April is possibly named, the name of the month probably comes from the verb aprire, which means to open. And when you think about it, it makes an awful lot of sense because flowers are opening, buds are opening, leaves are starting to open. Statistically, it's the driest of, or one of the driest of our months, but it doesn't prove to be that.
Not yet.
This
year. The early days, though.
But as I was thinking about April and what we might do, I came across a lovely poem by T.S. Eliot. And we might play a little bit of that just coming up to the ad break. And then after the ad break, we're going to be talking to Dr. Anne-Marie Power, Senior Lecturer in Marine Biology at the Ryan Institute and NUI Galway, all about the marine environment. So let's have a listen to Bob Dylan first, and he's reading a T.S. Eliot poem.
It's just like T.S. Eliot said, April is the cruelest month. His poem, The Wasteland, begins... April is the cruelest month, breeding. Lilacs out of the dead land mixing. Memory and desire stirring. Dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering. Earth and forgetful snow feeding. A little life with dried tubers. Summer surprises coming over the Starnbergersy. With a shower of rain, we stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. April is the cruelest month, breeding. Lilacs out of the dead land, mixing. Memory and desire stirring. Dull roots with spring rain.
Email us on studio at communityradiokilkennycity.ie.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the Artisan Food Retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're very welcome back to The Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt and I'm here with Mags Morrissey. And thank you to those who have contacted the show. We'll get to some of those text messages a little later on. We're live today, Friday from 4 to 5, and you can send in questions or comments by text to 086-353-7782 or by phone on 776-2777. If you're listening to a repeat of the show on Monday afternoon, please don't bother texting us as we won't get to see your message, but you can still email us anytime at kitchengarden@ckc.ie, kitchengarden@ckc.ie. Now, I'm joined on the line by Dr. Anne-Marie Power, Senior Lecturer in Marine Biology at the Ryan Institute and NUI Galway. Anne-Marie, how are you?
Hi, Francis. I'm great.
Lovely. Thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Not at all.
And now, I was doing a little research before the show, and I was having a look at your profile on Twitter, and you're on Twitter as @barnaclehunt. Is there a story behind you and hunting for barnacles?
There's a long story behind that, but just to put it very shortly, I had a project a while ago looking for goose barnacles, and we were working on a project about their cement and how they stick to rocks, because mm-hmm. rocks are wet and it's very difficult to get glue to work in wet environments. Mm-hmm. So we needed people who found some washed up barnacles to contact us so that we could actually get them for our aquarium. And that was the start of the Twitter account.
Ah, I see. And there's a brilliant photograph of piles and piles of these goose barnacles stuck onto a buoy, is it?
That's correct, yeah. They're fouling, so the species they're working on are not the goose barnacles that you can eat.
Mm.
They're a particular species that foul lots of different kinds of surfaces, and
right.
this makes their glue more interesting because they can attach to different kinds of surface, like
okay.
glass, plastic, wood, feathers, skin.
Oh, wow.
Somebody found one, somebody found some attached to a dead person's clothes in a lagoon in Venice.
Oh my God.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
And did they send them to you?
They wrote up the paper as a forensics paper because it indicated how long the body had been in the water, and they published it, and I was asked to review the paper.
Very good. Mm-hmm. And your interest in them, Anne-Marie, is that so that we can isolate how this cement works and maybe put it to use for us, or how we can prevent them sticking onto things that we don't want them fouling?
Both, Francis, actually. You know, it's the opposite side of the same coin.
Okay.
So you can. What we've done is we've found the genes that cause them to stick, so that create the protein, the genes that code for the protein that is found in their cement, and we are trying to express that protein in E. coli, in bacteria. And then what happens is bacteria are like little factories that will make the protein for you once you know what the protein's code is.
Okay.
And then you have some tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of purified protein that you can actually work with in tests. So obviously, I'm not a microbiologist. I'm working with microbiologists on that end of the project. I was more involved at the gene discovery end in the barnacles.
All right, very good.
Yeah.
I used to keep a boat in the marina up in Malahide, and every year we'd have to lift it out and do an awful lot of scraping. And the amount of stuff which creates its own little micro environment, you know, underneath the boat, which obviously slows down the progress as you're trying to push it through the water.
It does, and the other thing that happens is because this particular species of barnacle foul plastic, and because we have lots of plastic in the ocean, they sort of start the community off on bits of floating plastic, and then other things come in and they get rafted across from the US to our shores here.
I see.
So you get an invasive species angle then coming into play.
So they're actually creating rafts of like some life forms, some organisms, and some plastic, which of course keeps it floating, and then they're able to get distances further than they would have in the past.
Indeed, there's so much plastic around now. They would have attached things like seaweed.
Yes.
So in the past, and that would rot over time, but plastic doesn't go away, as we know, and it's very buoyant and it's sitting there. When it's large, it's sitting there at the surface, which is where they like to be. So they can raft for longer.
Right.
And you get things attached to fishing gear from the US. You know, you can clearly see it's from the US.
Mm-hmm. And it's arriving over here?
Yes.
My
and
God.
lots of things washed up on the Pacific coast of the US from Japan after the Fukushima disaster.
My God. So yeah. these little creatures, these barnacles, are kind of an indicator species of changes in the environment. So plastic allowing them to travel further. If there were changes in tides or currents, we might be able to see it by studying them as well.
Yes.
And of course, the volume of plastic.
That's very true. And you know, on a slightly less depressing note, we can also look at things like migrating turtles. So you can look at the goose barnacles attached to the turtle flippers as a way of understanding their migration. So I'm working with some guys in Florida on that. And we also, for a while, flirted a little bit with the Malaysian airline disaster, because there were goose barnacles attached. I don't know if you recall, there was a flapper on from the Malaysian Airlines.
Yeah, it floated up on...
It floated up on some of the Pacific Islands, and there were barnacles attached. And it was possible, you know, for a while, although we weren't able to get access to those samples, that we could have looked at the isotopic signature of those barnacles and said something about the ocean which the barnacles were in at the time they were growing.
Right.
And thus, potentially, where the aircraft was.
Where it went down.
Yeah.
That's
and
fascinating.
How come they didn't take you up on your advice there?
Well, my colleague was following it up, but there was a lot of politics around who got access to the samples, because
right.
they had washed up, I think, on a French-owned island. And, of course, it was Australia and Malaysia who were the main countries involved with the victims of that disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a little bit of argument about who should get the samples.
It's funny, isn't it? Politics comes into everything.
Yeah,
now, indeed. Anne-Marie, I know you're also interested in fish stocks and sustainable fishing. Isn't that right?
I am. I mean, I have a very bimodal, or, you know, you could say, bipolar scientific personality on the one hand. I'm looking at the Jean de Barnacle.
No, she doesn't.
who have you invited on the show, Max?
Well, you know, I have no problems with being bipolar this way. Absolutely none. So, but lots of other people, I suppose, find it difficult to put me in a box because I'm working on two very different things. I'm working on big things like fish, and I'm working on little things like glue proteins.
Yeah. And sustainable fishing, I know it's every time we hear reports from Europe around fishing, there's changes to quotas and who's allowed fish where, and some species are being protected and others, the stocks are no longer sustainable. Where are we at the moment in Europe,
well,
or in Irish waters?
Well, at the moment in the kind of Atlantic Europe waters, about 50% of the stocks are overfished. And I'm afraid to say that if you look at the countries whose stocks are overfished, Ireland and the UK do not come out well. We are overfishing more of our stocks than other countries are.
And is that Irish and UK fishermen who are doing this, or is it other countries' fishermen who are coming into our waters?
Both, okay. Of those things. So obviously the waters around Ireland are very rich and are opened up to our EU colleagues, because we're in an agreement, so our stocks are decided on the basis of relative stability, which means that the percentage of the stock that's given to Ireland out of, you know, the percentage, the size of the cake, if you like, that is given to Ireland every year is the same percentage, but the cake may get bigger or smaller, depending on how well that that overall stock is doing.
Right. And are there any particular species which are more in trouble than others?
Well, a classic example that I teach my students about would be cod in the Irish Sea. And that stock crashed in the 80s and still has not recovered.
Yeah.
So, it can be controversial because the fishermen may occasionally come across a dense aggregation of cod, but of course, lots of fish aggregate.
Yeah.
So just because you've found a patch with, you know, some decent looking sized cod in it doesn't mean that overall the stock is healthy. And all of the different, there are different reference points we use to establish whether it's healthy or not. And those have all been, all of the different reference points you can use have been terrible.
Right.
The 80s, so much so that an emergency plan was put in place in the year 2000.
The emergency emerges in the 1980s and our emergency plan gets put into place in 2000. Wow.
Indeed. I mean, I suppose they're an iconic species and there's always pushback. And it depends on how much the minister can resist. Well, it used to depend on how much the minister could resist the competing stakeholder voices. Luckily, and this again on a less depressing note, I suppose, since our new EU commissioner, the former one, Maria Damanaki, introduced reform of the common fisheries policy, we're on a path now where certain things which used to happen, such as in the past the quota was decided after the scientific advice, the quota was decided by the fisheries ministers, all sitting around a table and negotiating, and what that led to over time was that the best negotiators, the better your negotiating skills, the more quota you got. So you got to fish above the sustainable limit because you were a good negotiator and you were a good fisheries minister, in terms of your national take.
All right.
So that's no longer allowed now. It's going to be illegal under the reformed CFP, Common Fisheries Policy, and it's going to have to be according to scientific advice with no interference from the fisheries ministers.
Wow, and when does that start?
Well, it's happening on a phased basis already.
Okay.
The EU Commission don't want to put fishermen out of business overnight, so they do it on a phased basis. The other thing you may be aware of is the discards ban, which in legal parlance is known as the landings obligation. This is also coming in on a phased basis. and it means that this wasteful problem of, you know, people catching things which they didn't have a quota for and then just dumping them.
That really was criminal wastage. Now, like when you see that happening on a boat, the fish that's thrown back just because you don't have a quota to bring it back to land, it's thrown back into the sea. That fish is dead. So yeah, it's either eaten by something else or it's just rotting there.
Yeah, eaten by something else. I mean, scavengers were doing well. But anyway, it wasn't good for the stocks. And interestingly, for your listeners perhaps, is that was a campaign that was very strongly fought by chefs.
Mm.
That fish fight campaign, which you may recall Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall.
Of River Cottage fame.
Yes.
Yeah, he led that. I remember it well.
And there was like a Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall equivalent in every EU country.
Very good.
And they had mobilized their voters, mm-hmm. you know, who were organizing petitions and then lobbying their MEP. And it kind of started in the MEP, it started in the Parliament first before it kind of slowed down, and it actually made it into policy and into law.
It just goes to show that even in a huge institution like the European Union, an individual or a movement or a collection of people can make a difference.
I mean, this is the good side of social media and kind of connecting networks of people who are passionate about something. And I think, you know, another thing that people can do and consumers can do is they can buy sustainably sourced fish.
Well, I was just going to ask, there's a text message in here saying, we're being encouraged to eat more fish. What can we eat?
So there are some certification bodies which certify whether a particular fish stock is sustainably caught.
Mm.
So you can look for those labels. Now, labelling is a nightmare, and there's a lot of confusing labelling out there. So there are organisations such as Marine Stewardship Council, MSC, who have assessed certain fisheries according to like a series of about 28 indicators of sustainability. And once the stock, and what I mean by stock is fish caught by a fleet which is well described, well known,
mm-hmm.
With certain kind of gear, you know, so therefore a certain discard rate or not, no
and
discards.
It's comparable, so you're using the same kind of criteria each time.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you're fishing a certain area and you're not landing anything undersized and you're, you know, you're able to provide data. The data is required to show that that stock is not overfished.
So look out for those labels on any of the fish that you're buying. Is there any particular species which is doing particularly well? So is there a species that people can ask for in the fishmongers?
Well, I mean, if you want to get really encyclopedic about this, I would suggest that there is a public document for Irish consumers called Stockbook.
Stockbook.
And the Stockbook is published by the Marine Institute every year.
Okay.
And this will tell you about every single commercially caught, that means a species really with a quota.
Yeah.
It will tell you about how it's been doing for the last 30 years.
Right, okay.
Now, it's an encyclopedia, and you have to, you know, if you download it on your computer at home on a slow internet connection, it might take 20 minutes, but it's so worth it because now you can see, I mean, it's maybe a lower standard than the MSC would have, but you can actually see the data there for whether the stock is considered overfished or not,
and
the Marine Institute.
Make a decision yourself on that. And is there anybody who kind of digests all of that and makes a one or two word recommendation for consumers? Is there any social media outlet or website that people can keep an eye on?
I mean, I'm not aware of one that I've done due diligence on,
okay.
because I would hate to say something
I had not done due diligence
on myself. I do think that small boats, I mean, if you buy from a local guy on a small boat, it's less likely to be
as damaging.
The
stocks. Okay.
And the gear often is what is very damaging, and things like the MSC I mentioned a few few minutes ago also looks at things like, well, stock might be doing okay, but the gear that it's using may be tearing up the seabed.
Right, okay. Okay, something else that we have to consider. Well, Anne-Marie, it's fascinating. It's a topic that I'd love to talk to you again about in some more detail some other time, but we're running out of time here today. So Dr. Anne-Marie Parr, Senior Lecturer in Marine Biology at the Ryan Institute and NUI Galway, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye, Anne-Marie. Thanks.
Amazing stuff, really, isn't it?
Yes, like, fascinating.
It's brilliant to think that there are people whose jobs it is dedicated to looking after these for us, you know.
Well, the whole, like, looking at the glue makes a lot of sense, of course.
Mm.
But also on the piece of the plane that went down.
I know. Fascinating stuff. Yeah. Now, we're running a little bit late, so we better take a break. But coming up after the break, we're going to be talking to our friend Tongi over in Durrow and County Laois about freshwater fishing and the freshwater environment. And we might also ask him if he's getting any work done in his lovely garden. So we'll take a short ad break now, and we'll be back just after these. Email us on studio@communityradiokilkennycity.ie.
Kitchen Garden is sponsored by the artisan food retailers of Kilkenny.
And you're very welcome back to the Kitchen Garden. I'm Francis Nesbitt, and I'm here with Mags Morrissey. And thank you to those who have contacted the show. And there's lots of text messages there asking what species of fish people should buy in the fishmonger. So we might need to do another piece on that, Mags, and come up and mention it again next week.
We'll have a look at the stock book by the Marine Institute and...
We'll do the hard work for the listeners.
I was thinking you're not going to read that every Friday as you venture out to buy some fish for dinner.
I'm sure somebody else must be doing some work on it. But I'm delighted now that we're joined on the line by my friend Tongi de Tillet from Durrow and County Laois. Tongi, hi, how are you?
Hi, very well, Francis, on yourself?
Good, good, good. Now, Tongi, we've just been talking about the marine environment. A scientist over in NUI in Galway has been telling us about fisheries and sustainable fishing at sea. I know you, though, are a big fan of freshwater fishing.
Yes, it has been my job for 8 years, Francis, when I was fly fishing guide, mostly dry fly fishing on the Three Sisters.
Beautiful rivers. And I had the joy of going fly fishing with Tongi last year and the year before and some friends of his. And I can tell you that the way Tongi does it is the way it's supposed to be done. So we might fish the same stretch of water for an hour or two, and I'd see two fish. Meanwhile, Tongi would catch 12. So there's clearly some skill in this. But Tongi, this is a very unusual year. The rivers are very, very high, aren't they?
Yeah, they are very high, but it happens sometimes in the springtime, you know. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of fly fishing for dry fishermen, everything would start usually at the end of the month with the BBO on the autumn fly, the black gnat, and then you have the large dark olive. And so before that, usually... Except if you have a very low water, you wouldn't have too much dry fly fishing.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know.
And have you managed to get out onto the river at all yet this year?
No, not yet. Because I'm busy with my garden. So.
Well, we might talk to you about the garden in just a few minutes, but I paid a visit to the local river, the beautiful Kings River in Kells, several times over the last few weeks, and even on a sunny day, I didn't see too much in the way of a hatch, very little insect emerging.
I think one of your best bet would be to try flash throwing water, maybe around 2 o'clock, on for the marsh brown.
Okay.
On maybe a spate river.
Yeah.
Maybe the dinghy would be a good bet.
Up near Castlecomer.
Yeah.
Mm. And later on in the summer then, Tongi, in the rivers that you fish, how generally are stocks doing in the Three Sisters of trout?
Well, my understanding of the stock is that they went down maybe 7, 8, 9 years ago because we had a lot of crayfish, you know, the freshwater crayfish.
Yes.
The stock of crayfish collapsed, maybe due to a virus, I don't know exactly, but around 9, 10 years ago, the size of the fish dropped, the stock dropped as well. But now I can see the water, the crayfish coming back up, and I can see that the stock is coming up nicely, some rivers actually.
Okay, so improving in size on some of these rivers.
Improving some stretches, because some farmers as well, there is a new scheme where they can plant kind of loosely trees, you know, like oak trees.
Yeah.
It's kind of not commercial planting beside rivers.
Okay,
and that has a big effect on nitrogen and then on water quality in some stretches that I know.
One of the things that I've seen just from walking the rivers over the years is a stretch below anywhere animals have access to the river. It's almost dead, that stretch, because they throw up so much silt into the water, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
Dead. You have two things. You have the silt, then you have the hormones from the dairy cows.
Oh,
when they pee in the water,
yes,
that can have a huge effect on small fish, on of course all the silt in terms of spawning bed, on destroying the vegetation as well, all the good weeds, you know.
Yeah, it can also lead to massive amounts of bank erosion, so it tends to widen out a river where the animals can get down into it.
Yes, which means then that you don't have the faster current, fast flowing water, you end up with a slow stretch and you have less oxygen, less flies.
Okay, so if anybody is a farmer and has some land where they're allowing animals access to a river, if they were able to stop and find an alternative water source for the animals, that'd be great. And actually, I know one in Thomastown, Mags, right on the River Nore there, just below Grennan's Castle, where there's some access to the river there.
So. Yeah, it's quite a large area of access there. It's kind of a sandy bank.
Yeah.
It's a lot of that eroded.
I know sand martins move in there. I often see their nest there, but it is, you can see the bank over the years moving.
There's loads
the
of
bank.
Sand martins, though, so we've chatted about this before and stuff. It has created a habitat for the sand martins there, but maybe not as good for the fish.
Now, Tongi, you and I are definitely going to wet a fly over the summer and hopefully catch some trout that we can cook up and bring in here. But at the moment, then, there's very little kind of happening on that side. In the garden, how are you getting on?
In the garden, I was just watching some picture from last year on the years before, same date, first week of apples, I think in terms of phenology, there is not so much difference. The phenology is the stage of the plant at a certain time of the year. By example, the willow, this year, the one willow that I have in my place, flowered the first of April. Compared to the other years, it's kind of normal. I mean, I don't see too much difference.
Okay.
And with some plants as well, it's the same. So there's not so much difference in terms of plants, amazingly, yeah.
There certainly is in terms of ornamental cherry out at Crow and Cottages, I can tell you, because
there is. You have much more difference with the rose family, actually.
Yeah.
Because even roses, the foliage is back, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of the veg garden, I suppose the ground is way too wet to be putting anything down yet.
Myself, I follow a calendar of action. I have raised bed with no timber.
Okay.
So they dry much quicker. So I mean that in terms of gardening, I'm like usual, you know. I have the usual stuff done. I have the broad bean planted 3-4 weeks ago.
Okay.
I have the garden peas planted, I have the lettuce planted, broccoli, cabbage. The foliage is a little bit yellowish for the broad beans, but the rest is okay.
And have you your spuds in?
Spuds in 2-3 days ago, yeah.
Ah, very good, okay. Right, just around the...
you have to be very careful because the soil is very cold.
Yes.
So... myself, it would be like a lazy bed system.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually plant the potatoes on top of the soil. They were treated well before, so they are actually well budded, you know, well treated, and they won't be covered with soil.
Oh, okay.
They are covered with a loose layer of straw.
With straw?
Which protects them from the frost.
Mm-hmm.
And they are going to punch that layer of straw, and are going to come out of that in 3 weeks' time, I suppose.
Okay, and then you'll ridge up over those, will you?
No.
No?
You keep putting compost, a layer of mulch, sorry.
Yeah.
Just a mulch.
On top of that each time?
Off top, yeah. Then you don't have any light.
Oh, right, okay.
Then you don't have green potatoes.
And does that make it nice and easy to harvest them as well?
Yes, because most of the potatoes then would be on top quite shallow.
Yeah.
So it means that you can remove the mulch in June, July, and you can pick up some potatoes one by one and put back the mulch and come back a week after and pick more potatoes.
Just as you
need
them.
Don't have to dig them up.
Okay. That's a great way of doing it. I might actually pop out to your place later in the summer and take some.
It works very well with potatoes, yeah.
Is that something that you'd kind of cover or have photographs of on the Facebook page? Because you are on Facebook, aren't you, at Dunmore?
Yes, Dunmore Country School.
Country School, and you're also on Twitter and the website then as well, dunmorecountryschool.ie.
Yes, that would be the main
place
thing,
And you're doing a series of courses out there as well, aren't you, at the moment?
We are doing some gardening. We are running a springtime tomorrow. Springtime is a half day.
Mm-hmm.
It costs €50.
Okay.
And you will learn everything from compost to how to propagate plants from tomatoes to cabbage, and then the planting, sowing, everything I do in the springtime. And then I have small other courses. I have a beekeeping course, a natural beekeeping course on the French system, which is a very natural system.
Mm-hmm.
And then some one-day courses where I explain everything in one day, from compost to seed to table, basically.
Wow, there's an awful lot to learn in those, I'm sure. And details of those on dunmorecountryschool.ie?
Yes, exactly.
Super. Tongi, thanks a million for joining us on the show again, and I look forward to talking to you again during the summer about some of those fish.
Yes, thank you, Francis. So I would say tight line.
Thank you, Tongi. So it makes me, even talking about fishing, just makes me want to get out there and do some. But looking at the rivers at the moment, my God, they're lethal. They really are.
I'm sure.
And chocolate brown water. Imagine the poor fish are in sheltering
somewhere.
You can
be getting your bits ready, can you?
Yeah, absolutely. I can be doing some
polishing
preparation.
Polishing your flies or whatever you do.
Yeah, we probably won't have that conversation now, you and I, because it might ruin my memories of that lovely conversation I just had with Tongi. I love talking to Tongi, though, about the gardening and stuff like that. It's just, this is the system, this is the way you should do it, and I've it already done. How are you getting on?
If anybody feels that they're feeling inadequate after listening to him, I am. Well, no, I'm not, actually.
His garden is fabulous, though. If anybody hasn't visited Dunmore Country School, it's well worth a visit or paying the fee for one of his courses just to spend the day or the half day in the school. The garden is absolutely fabulous, and I know they do a lovely lunch out there as part of the course fee.
Oh, fabulous
as well.
Food. Be honest, you'd be eating all day. I've done it once.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's lovely. Now, this year, or this week, I've gone easy on the jobs to do in the garden, because one of the things that I absolutely love at this time of the year, even though the weather's been so miserable and stuff, the daffodils are lovely and they add a lovely touch of colour, but planted the way we tend to plant them in long lines and stuff, they never look particularly natural. So the one flower that I look forward to seeing most every spring is the primrose. I love to see the primrose emerging on the kind of banks and the in the hedgerows and stuff out at Crowan. It's a personal favourite, an absolutely beautiful plant. Primula vulgaris is the native one, the pale yellow, almost white, or sometimes into pink kind of flower. It's part of a huge family of plants. There's 500 species in the Primula group, but the one that I particularly love is that Primula vulgaris. So primrose, the first flower that we might see. So I went looking for some of those today, and sure enough, there they are in and around the daffodils. So I'd strongly recommend people go have a look at those. And if they're in large numbers, the leaves and the flowers are both edible. So you could harvest a few to throw into a salad. The flavour is kind of somewhere between lettuce and, you know, those bitter salad greens, the kind of oriental greens, yeah.
I think they look so nice. I don't think I'd actually pick them, but
the flowers really perk up a salad. So if you're if you are making a salad and a few little primrose flowers on it, just they look really, really pretty. Unless, of course, you're my nephew who hates flowers in his dinner, as he told me one time last summer.
I kind of do.
You don't like flowers in your dinner?
No.
I like them in a salad. I think they look lovely. And something else then to bear in mind, if you don't want to do any work this week, is that next Tuesday, 10th of April, Terence Reeves Smith will give the second of the garden talks in the Parade Tower in the castle here in Kilkenny. The subject of the talk this time is trees in Irish parks and demesnes. domains, and Terence is a senior inspector for historic monuments and buildings in Northern Ireland, and he really is an expert on that subject. I've heard him speak before at RHS gatherings. He's also written extensively on archaeological, architectural and garden history. So the talk is the 10th of April in the Parade Tower in the Castle. It kicks off at 8 and the doors will open at 7:30, and it's free and all are welcome. Anything you have planned to look out for? Or in the
swallows.
Garden? Swallows, look out for
11th
the swallows.
Of April is my date for swallows. Last couple of years they've arrived up to Bonskaha on the 11th, so let's curious to see what happens this year.
Okay, right, so we'll keep our eyes open during the week for swallows. And actually, while you're looking up into the sky, you might see another little favourite of mine at this time of the year, a white butterfly, which looks like the cabbage butterfly but isn't, so it's harmless to us. It's the orange tip butterfly.
The males have the orange.
That's right, tip. And the females have a nice little black triangle on the tip of their wings. Beautiful hairy butterfly, though, well worth looking out for. Right, well, we better go. We've run out of time again, so we're going easy on the jobs for you this week. We hope you enjoyed the show, and thank you to all of those who got in touch with us. Remember, you can get in touch during the week with any ideas, suggestions or questions you might have on Twitter. I'm at Nesbitt F, or Mags is at Mags Morrissey, or you can email kitchengarden@crkc.ie. Today we're going to leave you with a little piece of music, and this time it's Simon and Garfunkel and their 1966 song April, Come She Will, a song that encourages us to look forward to warmer times, maybe. We'll be back next week.
When streams are ripe and swelled with rain, may she will stay, resting in my arms again. June, she'll change her tune. In restless walk she'll prowl the night. July she will fly and give no warning to her flight. August, die she must. The autumn winds blow chilly and cold. September, I'll remember a love once knew.